Matthew chapter 8 verses 14 to 22, the 37th talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew, was presented by Ron Julian on January 14, 2018 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2018. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in the first few minutes of the recording having poorer sound quality.
We are in chapter 8 of Matthew. In this section, Matthew is telling the story of various miracles that Jesus did. Last week, we looked at two stories that were noteworthy for the faith of the persons healed. That is, in each case, the person sought Jesus out and showed that they understood who he was by asking him to heal them. They understood that Jesus was sent by God with the authority to act on God's behalf. Jesus had the authority to decide that a person would be healed, and then indeed they would be healed. So in the stories we saw last week, a leper and then a Gentile centurion each came to the same conclusion. They looked at Jesus. They decided not only can God heal, but Jesus can heal because he acts with the authority given to him by God. So in both of those stories, you see someone confronting the evidence about who Jesus was and deciding he indeed is the guy to go to. Our next little healing story is in Matthew 8, 14 to 15. When Jesus came into Peter's home, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick in bed with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she got up and waited on him. I don't have a lot to say about this story. There are a few more details in Mark and Luke's account of this event. Matthew has it stripped down to its essential features. Jesus goes to Peter's house. The mother of Peter's wife is sick with a fever. Jesus heals her, and she gets up and waits on him. There's no great lesson in this story about the mother-in-law's faith or anything like that. I suspect that this story was remembered and passed on because of the personal significance that it had to Peter. Peter saw a lot of strangers come up to Jesus and receive healing, but in this case, Jesus is relieving a worrisome illness in Peter's own family. As she got up and waited on Jesus, I think the way to think about that is to remember the very important place that hospitality had in their culture. When guests come into your house, you have an obligation to take care of them. You need to make them comfortable, invite them to sit down, give them something to eat and drink. It is your responsibility to take care of them. This is what Peter's mother-in-law would have wanted to do for Jesus when he entered the house, especially because he, in essence, was kind of like her son-in-law's boss coming to visit at home. I mean, you got to be nice to the boss, right? And the little thing about him being the Messiah and everything. So she would have wanted to offer him hospitality, but she can't because she is so sick with a fever that she can't get out of bed. So the fact that she got up and waited on him was evidence that he cured her quite quickly. She could get up and offer the hospitality that would have been important to her and that she would have been doing if she hadn't been sick. So in this story, Jesus healed a relative of one of his own disciples. The personal nature of this story helps us to remember that these miracles are not just flashy supernatural events. I always think about the sorts of things, the sorts of magic tricks that Jesus could have done to establish that he had supernatural powers. But that's not what these are. They are acts of mercy by Jesus on God's behalf. These illnesses bring great suffering, including the possibility of death, and Jesus is relieving that suffering. And in this case, relieving the suffering in Peter's own family. These acts of healing are not just miracles, they are meaningful miracles. And in fact, I think that Matthew is about to explain that to us in the next section.
So I'm going to move on to the next section, starting in 8:16. When evening came, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were ill. This was to fulfill what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet. He himself took our infirmities and carried away our diseases. When we started this series in Matthew, we talked a lot about the way Matthew uses the Old Testament. We saw a number of examples where Matthew said Jesus fulfilled Old Testament passages, and he used that language. This fulfilled what was said by Isaiah, or this was fulfilled what was said by the prophet. When the child Jesus left Egypt, Matthew said it fulfilled the passage in Hosea, "Out of Egypt I called my son." But as we saw, that passage was not a prediction of Jesus at all. It was talking about the Exodus, when God took Israel out of bondage in Egypt. We talked about how Matthew has a larger concept for the word fulfilled. When we understand the Old Testament passage in its full context, then we can see that Jesus brings out the significance of that passage in some way. He fulfills it by filling out the implications of it through his actions or what happened to him or whatever. This is a difficult concept, and we're not going to go back and look at all of those difficult passages again, but those earlier passages raise a question for us here, because here's that word fulfilled again. Matthew says that Jesus' healing miracles fulfill the passage from Isaiah, "He himself took our infirmities and carried away our diseases," is the way it's translated here. Is Matthew saying that Isaiah predicted that Jesus would do healing miracles? Is that what Matthew is saying? Once again, I'm going to argue no, but not exactly. It's tricky, because the passage from Isaiah is, I believe, a prediction of the coming Messiah. We are not wrong to see it as a prediction that pertains to Jesus. But what exactly is Matthew doing with this verse that he's quoting? That's something that we're going to have to talk about a little bit. This is the famous passage, Isaiah 53, the passage about the suffering servant. I do believe that Jesus is, in fact, the suffering servant that Isaiah was talking about. This is a debated topic among biblical scholars, but that's the thing that makes the best sense to me at this point, that Isaiah 53 really is meant to be talking about the Messiah. The question, though, is what is Matthew doing here? Why is he pointing to this verse, and what is he saying about it? So I want to talk about that for a little bit. First, I want to make a general comment about the words used in this passage. The Isaiah passage, of course, is written in Hebrew. Matthew is giving a translation of it in Greek. Both Hebrew and Greek have words that they use with reference to illness and disabilities and things like that. These words they start with sort of literal meanings like weakness, pains, burdens, things like that. All of these words can be used to refer to bodily, physical problems. So many times we translate in English these words as sick or ill or something like that, because that seems to be the idea that the word is pointing to. But sometimes these same words are used to refer to other kinds of weakness and burdens. We can be emotionally tired or spiritually weak or burdened with worries and so on. And we can all see how language would do a thing like that. There are times in my life when the burdens of my life feel very similar to being sick. I mean, being sick kind of drags you down, and other kinds of burdens and worries and character flaws and things like that can also drag you down and have that same sort of debilitating effect on your life. So one question we have to try to sort out is exactly what it is that Isaiah means by these words and what exactly Matthew means in his Greek translation. So I hope I'm being clear here. Part of the issue is, are we talking about diseases and illness? Is that what Isaiah was talking about? Or are we talking about something broader? One thing we can notice right away that might help a little bit, Jesus is described as doing two things here. He's healing the sick, but he is also casting out unclean spirits. So Peter's mother-in-law is an example of someone who was sick. She had a fever. She was ill, and he healed the fever. But the demon-possessed man who attacked people who were passing by was not sick, as we think of sickness, but he was burdened, suffering, disabled by the hostile influence of the demonic spirit. And Jesus was doing both of those things. He was releasing people from illness. He was releasing people from demonic possession. So even there, we can see that Matthew is dealing with something that's broader than just having a disease. People's lives are being hampered and degraded in some way. People are suffering because of disease and disability and demonic possession. And Jesus is acting to solve that problem supernaturally. Okay, so let's go back to the Isaiah passage and talk about it a little bit. We're in Isaiah 53. We'll start right from the beginning. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? In this passage, the arm of the Lord, I think, is this suffering servant that is about to be described. God is going to act. He is going to deliver and rescue, and he's going to use his arm. It's like the image of someone who is reaching out with his arm to grab someone, to rescue them, to do something for them. Only in this case, the arm is this person that he has delegated to do this task. It is the servant that he is about to describe that is the arm of the Lord. Okay? And as I will keep saying it, but I'm not going to argue for this, but I'm convinced at this point that in Isaiah 53, that suffering servant ultimately is meant to point to the Messiah. The Messiah is the arm of God that is going to accomplish God's purposes. Now we're going to describe this arm. For he grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of parched ground. He has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. So right away we see this surprising thing about this arm of the Lord, this one sent by God. He doesn't look like he came from God. He isn't shining with divine glory or radiating power. He's not particularly impressive. He's just a not particularly impressive, not particularly attractive guy. That's who the arm of the Lord is. Verse 3, he was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. Okay, so the verse that Matthew quotes is in that section that I just read, verse 4. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. We notice that the translators here did not translate these words as illness or sickness or something like that. The words they used are griefs and sorrows. They can certainly do that because these words have a range of meanings, as we discussed earlier. Sometimes these words are about physical sickness. Sometimes they are more broadly referring to troubles of various sorts. And I think we can see why the translators went in the broader direction. It was the It's the direction that I would go. If we look at verse 3, he was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Those are the two words that we're talking about in the next verse. He is a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. So let me read 3 and 4 again with an emphasis on the repetition of these words. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised and we did not esteem him. Surely our griefs he himself bore and our sorrows he carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. So it doesn't seem to make sense to me to take it that the servant is described in 3 as a man who's acquainted with sickness and disease. That's not really what it's getting at, I don't think. He is acquainted with troubles, with sorrows, with sufferings. But as it turns out, it is our troubles, our sorrows, our sufferings that he is ultimately carrying. How can that be? Well, Isaiah goes on then to be more specific. But he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. Okay, so I think this is filling out, continuing the theme that got started in the earlier verses. We are not just people with griefs and sufferings. We are transgressors. We have committed iniquities. We have gone astray. We have turned to our own way. The sufferings that we encounter in this life ultimately come back to ourselves. We have turned away from God, and life is difficult because of it. We are evil, rebellious people who have brought our troubles upon ourselves, and yet he has taken the punishment that we deserved. And he's done this so that we might have well-being. If I remember, it's shalom at that spot. So that we might be healed. Our lives are broken, and we suffer in many ways, and we don't deserve any better. But the servant has taken our guilt upon himself so that we might be released from guilt and ultimately released from suffering and find peace, well-being, shalom. Later, Isaiah says that he will render himself as a guilt offering. That's the sacrificial language, that we're guilty, but he is offering himself as the offering for our guilt. The passage concludes, and we'll go jump to verse 11 here, as a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, as he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he himself bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors. So, I mean, there's a lot going on in Isaiah 53. I'm just kind of telling you what makes sense to me at this point as I look at what's happening there. Isaiah says that the suffering servant is a humble, unimpressive man who is acquainted with troubles. He's acquainted with sorrows and grief. But in fact, it is our sorrows and our griefs that he has taken upon himself. He is going to offer his life as a guilt offering so that we can be forgiven and healed, so that we can enter back into well-being and peace. That's what I think is happening in Isaiah 53. Okay, so now let's go back to Matthew. When evening came, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were ill. This was to fulfill what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet. He himself took our infirmities and carried away our diseases. That's the way the New American Standard translates it there. Notice, this is quite different than the way New American Standard translates the Hebrew in Isaiah. There it was sorrows and griefs. Here it is infirmities and diseases. And part of that is related to how they're understanding and translating the Greek words that Matthew has chosen to use. But we need to talk about that a little bit. So I have several things to say as we try to sort this out. First of all, I believe that Isaiah 53 is indeed a prediction of the coming Messiah. That's what makes the most sense to me at this point. I believe Jesus actually himself makes that claim. I think Jesus is the suffering servant who offers his life as a guilt offering so that his people can escape their sorrows and grief. And likewise, Matthew also knows that Isaiah 53 is predicting Jesus. So, it's interesting, as a thought experiment, Matthew could have used this passage later when he describes the crucifixion. Suppose we were not in this context, but we jump ahead to the end of Matthew. He could have said, Jesus died for our sins on the cross. This was to fulfill what Isaiah said, he himself took our sorrows and carried our grief. Okay, so hopefully that's clear. Matthew then would be quoting Isaiah as a direct prediction that Jesus was going to offer himself as a guilt offering so that he could take upon himself the sorrows and griefs of his people and restore them to health and life. So Isaiah did give what is essentially a direct predictive prophecy that Jesus would release people from their sorrows by taking them on himself, by dying for their sins. So Matthew could have done that. He could have claimed this passage as kind of a direct prophecy of the offering of Jesus' life on the cross. We know, I think, that Matthew knows that Jesus did that. He understands clearly that that's what Jesus accomplished on the cross. For example, Matthew is going to report later what Jesus said at the Lord's Supper. And when he had taken a cup and given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for forgiveness of sins. So there Jesus is directly saying, I am going to give my life for the forgiveness of sins of my people, which is essentially what is described in Isaiah 53. Matthew knows that this is what Jesus came to do. And I think he knows that Isaiah 53 predicted it. So he could have used Isaiah 53 as a direct prophecy when talking about the crucifixion. But that's what is interesting. That's not what he does. He says that when Jesus heals people and casts out demons, that is what fulfills Isaiah 53. And I would argue that Isaiah 53 is not a direct prediction that the Messiah would come and do miracles of healing. That's not really what Isaiah 53 is saying. So, what is Matthew doing? I think that once again, that Matthew has this broader idea of what it means for Jesus to fulfill something in an earlier passage. I think what Matthew intends to highlight for us is one of the meanings of Jesus' miracles. And let me see if I can explain this. I hope that this makes sense. A miracle of healing does several things at once. There are several things going on when Jesus heals someone miraculously. First of all, it is a supernatural event that demonstrates how God is with Jesus. It testifies to his authority over disease and demonic possession because God has given him that authority. So when Jesus makes the claim to be the Messiah, he can back it up with the power of God at work through the authority given to him that he has authority over anything in this world, including the demons, including disease. That's one thing that a miracle of healing does. A miracle of healing is also an act of mercy to a specific person. God was being merciful to that man who had leprosy. God was being merciful to the servant of the centurion, and probably to the centurion as well. God was being merciful to Peter's mother-in-law. Each one individually can say to God, "Thank you for rescuing me from my debilitating sufferings." But there's another thing that a miracle of healing does. It also sends a kind of symbolic message to all of us. The supernatural signs that Jesus does are merciful acts of deliverance. There is a reason why the supernatural signs Jesus does are acts of deliverance. Deliverance from disease, deliverance from disability, deliverance from unclean spirits. Again, I point out that I've often thought about the fact that there are all sorts of impressive things that Jesus could have done. He talks about how if you have faith like a mustard seed, you could tell a mountain, be cast into the sea. But it's interesting, we don't ever see Jesus tell a mountain to be cast into the sea. That would be impressive. If he had done that, everybody would be going, "Whoa, who is this guy?" But he doesn't do that. He does a number of things, but the most common miracle that he performs is a miracle of a merciful act of deliverance from disease, from disability, from demonic possession. And I think part of the reason for that is that it is appropriate for Jesus to prove who he is by doing miraculous acts of merciful deliverance, because that is ultimately what he came to do. Not just to heal individual people here and there. He didn't just come to make Peter's mother-in-law's fever go away. He did do that, but that's not his ultimate purpose in coming. His ultimate purpose is to mercifully deliver all his people from their troubles and sufferings. And how is he going to do that? By dying for their sins, bringing God's ultimate mercy upon them, and bringing them into life, ultimately, in the kingdom of God. So there's something very appropriate, kind of symbolically appropriate, for the kinds of miracles that Jesus was doing. It's in keeping with the kind of person he is, and most importantly, the kind of thing that he came to do. So this is how I'm looking at this. I don't think Matthew is saying Isaiah 53 predicted that Jesus would do miracles of healing. I think what Matthew is saying is something like Isaiah 53 predicted that Jesus would die as a guilt offering for his people so they could be rescued, mercifully rescued from their sorrows and sufferings. And that is the symbolic significance of the miracles of healing. That is the message that they send somewhat obliquely. Jesus is giving a physical demonstration through miraculous healings that he came for the purpose of mercifully delivering us from our sorrows and sufferings. He didn't come, I mean, not everybody gets to be healed by Jesus. Certain people did. But that act of merciful deliverance in this person's life, and then in this person's life, and then in this person's life, points us to the ultimate reason that he came, which is to mercifully deliver us from our ultimate troubles and sorrows, which are rooted in our sin and our guilt. He heals disease to remind us that he came to heal us from the bigger problem, all of the consequences of sin and guilt in our lives. That's what I think Matthew is saying. I don't think he, like I said, I don't think that he's claiming that the passage predicted that Jesus would do miracles of healing. It predicted that Jesus would come and take our sorrows upon himself and deliver us through making his life as a guilt offering. But what Matthew is saying is, and you can see that theme, that important theme spoken, pictured in the miracles that Jesus did in delivering people from various temporal and physical troubles right now. Okay, so if I'm right about this, we have gotten a picture of the significance of Jesus' healing miracles, that there are a number of things involved, that as we look at these stories of the miracles of Jesus, that there are a number of things that we see, and there may be more, but right now, from what I've seen so far, this is what I would say. First, they are an opportunity for individuals to exercise faith in Jesus. That's what we saw with the story about the leper and the centurion who came and are basically being commended in these stories for the decision that they came to, that they recognize Jesus has the authority to do this. God can heal, and Jesus has been given authority by God to act on God's behalf to bring that healing about. They had to think about who Jesus was. Do I have good reason to believe that there really is a God who can heal? Do I have good reason to believe that Jesus is acting with an authority given to him by God? In other words, do I have good reason to believe that Jesus is the Messiah sent by God? And what we saw in those stories, and there are other stories like them, where before the miracle happens, the person is having to decide, am I going to go to Jesus because I believe that he is who he has demonstrated himself to be? In the case of the leper and the case of the centurion, each of them answered that question, yes, I know who he is. So I'm going to him acknowledging that he is the one who can decide whether the healing is going to happen. That's who God has sent him to be. So, first of all, the miracle stories sometimes, not all the stories, but sometimes show an opportunity for someone to decide before the miracle happens, what do I think about this guy Jesus? Second, the miracles of healing are supernatural events that demonstrate Jesus' God-given authority. He can heal people because he is the Messiah sent by God. That is a strong confirmation that he indeed is that Messiah. And we're going to see that theme explored quite explicitly here pretty soon in some upcoming stories. Third, miracles of healing are concrete acts of mercy to specific individuals. Each healed person can rightly thank God for being merciful. Peter's mother-in-law can thank God for delivering her from her specific illness. The leper can thank God because he is no longer a leper. The centurion can thank God because his servant has been healed from what seemed to have been a terrible illness. And then finally, if I'm understanding what Matthew is doing with Isaiah, miracles of healing are meaningful, symbolic acts that remind us of the purpose for which Jesus came. He came to bring God's merciful restoration. Each miracle of healing is like a little picture that points beyond itself to the ultimate merciful restoration that Jesus will bring with his death and resurrection. Okay, so right now I would say we see at least those four things in the stories of the miracles. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next story. I'll try to look for questions after we look at everything I've got here today, I think. So we're in verse 18 now of Matthew. Now when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to depart to the other side of the sea. Then a scribe came and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Jesus said to him, "The foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." In the Gospels, we see a little bit of an ambiguous relationship that Jesus has with the people. On the one hand, he is traveling from town to town for the very purpose of making himself known. He is proclaiming the kingdom of God. He is doing miracles that authenticate his claim, at least his implicit claim. He doesn't often say so, but his implicit claim that God has sent him and that he is the Messiah. He's calling people to be his disciples, to repent, to enter into the kingdom. So he's going, in one sense, to call attention to himself and his message and to proclaim it. But in all of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we have these times where we see that Jesus is unwilling to kind of arouse a mob. He doesn't want a huge crowd of people following him around. In John, there's the episode where after he feeds the 5,000, people are saying, let's make him king. And that's one of the things I think that he's concerned about. This is not what I'm looking for. I do not want to get a mob of people worked up and saying, we're with him. So whenever that starts to come around, he leaves and goes someplace else. Okay, so in this case, he sees that a crowd is developing, and so he says to disciples, we're going to get in a boat, and we're going to go to a different part of the Sea of Galilee. As it turns out, what's about to happen is they're going to sail the Sea of Galilee and head down to the southeast, I think it is, and they're going to end up in Gentile territory. It's a significant move that he's making at this point, I think. Among the people who are following Jesus at the time, I don't think we're talking about one of the 12, but others who are following Jesus, who are interested, who think he may be sent from God, perhaps the Messiah. A scribe is probably a Pharisee, certainly one who has studied and taught the law. He wants to be a follower of Jesus, and he sees that Jesus is getting ready to leave, and I think what he's saying is, I want to come with you. Wherever you go, that's where I'm going. And Jesus gives him a somewhat discouraging response. The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. As I see this, I think Jesus' response helps us to see something of what the scribe might have been thinking. So he's coming to believe that Jesus might be the Messiah, I think. I mean, he wants to follow him because he thinks God is with this guy. And as a student of the scriptures, he knows who the Messiah is. He is the promised king in the line of David. He's going to sit on David's throne. He's going to restore the Jewish people to their promised land. He's going to triumph over the rulers of all the nations. In particular, he's going to triumph over the Romans and kick them out. So, sure, right now, following Jesus seems to involve tramping around the countryside a bit. You know, this is not, at the moment, this glorious thing that I'm looking for. But if he is the Messiah, then the scribe surely has a picture of where he is headed. He is headed to Jerusalem. He may be wandering around right now, but he has a date with destiny in Jerusalem where he will claim his rightful throne. Jesus is heading to his place. I think it's intriguing that in another context, Jesus refers to Jerusalem as the city of the great king. That is his city, because it is. Jerusalem is ultimately the city of the Messiah. So he may be a poor wandering teacher right now, but soon he will be sitting on his throne, established in glory, with all the world belonging to him. That's a guy I want to follow. So, of course, ultimately, that is correct. That is where this is headed in the end. It hasn't happened yet, but someday Jesus will return and rule over all the nations. He will establish the righteous rule of God over everything. He will rule from the throne of David and establish righteousness and peace, and he will be in his place. He will have his rightful place, his place of glory, his place of rest, his place where he is established and ruling over all earth. But that is not where this story is going. That is not what is about to happen to Jesus. Matthew is in the process of telling us Jesus' story in the gospel. Jesus is headed to Jerusalem. That's the way the story is told. Jesus does have a date with destiny in Jerusalem, but he's not going there in triumph. He is going to be rejected and executed. So I think what Jesus is saying is something like this. You may think that in following me, you are following a guy who is going to take his rightful place in this world, and you're going to have a place right there with me. But you're not really getting the picture. I don't have a place in this world. Others have a place. Even the foxes and the birds have their place. But I have no place here. Ultimately, that is what the world is going to tell me. You have no place here, and I will be executed. So you need to be prepared. I have no place in this world to offer you. The world doesn't like me, and if you truly follow me, it is not going to like you either. So that's what I understand the essence of his statement to be. You know, you might think that I'm the guy who's got it all, but and that's why you're following me. But actually, in this world right now, I don't have anything. And that's where it's going to end up. So you'd better be prepared for that. This then is followed by a little story about another potential disciple. In 21, another of the disciples said to him, "Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "Follow me, and allow the dead to bury their own dead." Now, I'm not exactly sure why I'm talking to you about this passage, because I have no idea what's going on here. Let me tell you what seems to me to be the possibilities, and you tell me which you think is the most reasonable. I'm kind of leaning in one direction, but it's a little challenging. So, I've seen three proposals for what the man is asking Jesus in this case. It might seem fairly obvious what he's asking, but actually there are several possibilities for what he might be asking. The first proposal is the obvious one. His father has just died, and he wants to go attend to the funeral arrangements before he follows Jesus. So he's asking to meet up with Jesus a day or so later. "Look, my father just died, got to go deal with the funeral, you know, get everybody established and everything. Be a day or two. Tell me where you're going to be, I'll meet you up." Okay, so it's hard to imagine that Jesus would have a problem with this. I mean, it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that's particularly, that he's somehow gone over whole hog into worldliness or something. I mean, helping your family deal with the funeral arrangements for your father seems like a pretty reasonable thing. So if this is what he's getting at, it's a little hard to see exactly how it works. For me, at least, I haven't been able to put it together. I can imagine the possibility that Jesus doesn't really mean it. That in this scenario, what he's doing is saying something so sort of outrageously provocative and almost nonsensical that it sort of brings the person up short as to what it is that his values are. "Let the dead bury their own dead." What does that even mean? Literally, that is impossible, but perhaps it highlights something like, ultimately, your priorities are not those sorts of concerns. Your priorities involve following me. So, I mean, it's kind of, and ultimately, if the man was saying, "So are you saying I shouldn't go?" Then Jesus might say, "Well, no, go. I mean, take care of the funeral, come back, but let the dead bury their own dead." It's kind of I'm using this little episode to remind you of where ultimately your allegiance is going to have to lie. I'm not really satisfied with that way of thinking about it. So that's possibility number one, but right now I don't really know what to do with that one. Possibility number two, his father is not dead yet. The expression, "let me bury my father," could mean, and there are, I've seen these kind of contexts in English literature at times, and it is argued that this was an idiom in the Jewish context, means Let me stay and carry out my everyday responsibilities to my family until my father dies. So let me bury my father is, don't call me away from my family while I still have obligations to my father and mother. Let me bury him first, and then I will be free to come and join you. In this case, then, Jesus really could have a problem with what he's saying. And if he sees it as basically using the excuse of family responsibilities to justify himself in not choosing to follow Jesus. We might see the dead, burying the dead here, as a metaphorical kind of statement. If you don't follow me, you have chosen to stay among those who are spiritually dead. They have made this world their priority. Don't use the future death of your father as an excuse to avoid following me now. Let those who are already spiritually dead use that excuse. But, you know, they can stay and refrain from following me, but you need to decide to follow me. That one might work. That one has more promise to me. Proposal number three is something that I've come across that is argued by some people, is that there was a Jewish practice that involved a kind of a second phase to burial that is being referred to here. The body is put in the tomb, and it's left there for around a year until it totally decays. Then the bones are collected and put in what's called an ossuary. So the man could be saying something like, let me hang around here for a year until I have fulfilled all the culturally expected burial practices. Not just putting my dad in the tomb, but I need to stay and be prepared to go through these ritual things, which involve getting his bones ultimately and putting them in an ossuary. And so in that scenario, Jesus might be saying, okay, well, look, if you had just needed to stay and deal with the funeral or something, that would be fine. But you have let your commitment to a particular cultural practice be your excuse for not following me. Your father is already there among the dead. Let them deal with him now. If they want his bones in a jar, let them do it. I mean, but right now, you need to follow me. I don't know. That one seems sort of weird to me. It all depends on whether that's in fact an actual cultural practice that is seriously likely to inform what's happening in this spot. And I don't know enough to know about that. So I'm kind of stuck with, I'm not exactly sure exactly what the logic of this thing is. All I can say in the end is that I think it's clear that Jesus wants to communicate to him that he needs to follow him, and that he should not let anything in this world stop him from following him. I mean, that's clear, I think. Maybe it's not clear, and I'm totally missing the point, but I think that's somehow or another, you follow the logic through, one of these paths, they're all going to end up there somehow. Okay, so we have here two short cryptic little episodes. First, the guy who wants to follow Jesus, but Jesus tells him that the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And the second one with the guy who wants to bury his father, and Jesus says, let the dead bury their dead. Both of these little stories remind us that we tend to be short-sighted. The scribe is thinking about the short-term payoff of following the Messiah, I think. Soon he will be established in his place of glory, and I'll be there, right there with him. The man who has a father to bury is tempted to see his earthly cares, one way or another, as more important than the eternal issues involved in following Jesus. So one would be saying, I will follow Jesus if it pays off now. One would be saying, I will follow Jesus if it doesn't get in the way of things that I need to do now. To both of them, Jesus is saying, there's nothing better to be gained than the salvation that I have come to bring. There is nothing in this world more important than following me and finding life. Okay, so that's not entirely satisfying, but that's as far as I got in thinking about those little things. So we have some time here now for any questions or comments you might have.
Thanks. The dead burying the dead thing is interesting. And I think I completely agree with like the significance that you're giving to it. Stefan and I were reading the Noah account this morning, and it's kind of interesting thinking, and we were talking with the kids about it, and thinking about ourselves kind of in the situation of Noah's kids. Like, your dad says God's going to flood the earth, and he wants you to help him build an ark as quickly as possible. Can you give up all of your aspirations and free time to work on that? It's hard to imagine, you know, doing that. But it's so clear in the story that that is the correct response. And it's interesting thinking about that dynamic here. If Noah had said to some person around, you know, come on, come into the boat, for example, if God had told him to go and do that, and the guy was like, well, first I need to bury my dad that just died. You get this picture of, well, all these people are about to die. Like, God's going to send this flood, and they're all going to be dead. Like, the dead burying their own dead, you know? Like, it takes on this sort of irony and almost comical, mm-hmm. tragic aspect to it. And I wonder, it just kind of made me think about, in light of this passage, if Jesus is seeing it in a similar way. Like, he is about to do something, and there's sort of a pressing nature to it. Like, these people have in front of them the opportunity to be saved. And I'm assuming Jesus maybe knows more about this guy's personal situation than we would, but if he has the insight to say, you know, those people who are behind and who aren't going to follow me in this particular moment, they're about to be swept away in the flood. Like, there's no one to save them, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. So mm-hmm. that's all. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting that he's getting into a boat. And I don't know that there's any significance to that, but okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't pin anything on that, but.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, that sense of urgency, I think, is there. I mean, that is there. This question about following me, you don't have anything more important to deal with than that question. And it's urgent. Yeah.
Ron, what is the significance that he's called a disciple?
Well, I guess there are different ways you could go with that. What makes sense to me is there are a number of people that are referred to as disciples, not just the 12. There are lots of people, anyone who decided, hey, I'm gonna follow this guy around for a while and see what he has to say, those people get referred to as disciples. So we have stories of disciples who ultimately decide to leave. They don't want to be disciples anymore because of what Jesus has said or something like that. So I assume in both of these cases, we have people who are interested enough in Jesus that you could see them as they want to follow him, but the question is, do they understand what's at stake and what it is that they're following? But yeah, I definitely don't see it as defining him as a genuine believer or something like that. It's just an interested party.
And this is kind of a screwball question, but as I was listening, I was sort of kind of trying to listen as a total newbie, an unbeliever, and I thought I heard you say that it was an act of mercy that Jesus would heal people. And my response to that is, why would a sick, hurting person not be healed because they were sick and hurting, that the And I may not really believe this. I'm just kind of that. Is it a fact that Jesus would demand confession and repentance before he would help a hurting person?
Or? No, I should have been clearer about that. I think the concept of mercy has different flavors to it. The basic idea of mercy is I am extending myself on someone's behalf, even though technically speaking, it is not necessarily my problem. I mean, and if I see someone on the street, you know, a homeless person, and I take them a blanket, that is an act of mercy. And I think in the Bible at times the word mercy is used in that way. It's not, I forgive you, I have decided that your sins have been forgiven, therefore I will give you a blanket. It is, I am extending favor to you. You didn't come to me and do something for me that made me favorably inclined towards you or anything. I just am extending favor to you as an act of, and the word would be mercy. So,
would we use the word compassion instead?
Mm-hmm. Mercy and compassion, yeah, close. So, yeah, so, but one kind of rolls into the other. When we're dealing with God, we do have the problem that we are actually unworthy of his favor. So his merciful acts are quite merciful. He is actually overlooking all the reasons he would have to reject us and being favorable toward us instead. So, yeah, I didn't mean to imply that the miracles were because Jesus looked at this person and said, oh, God's going to forgive your sins, so it's okay for me to heal you. I didn't mean anything like that.
So the statement that God sends rain on the just and the unjust
mm-hmm.
is just a matter of a kind of a scattergun approach to doing good things to people,
mm-hmm.
quote-unquote, whether they deserve it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't have any problem with this, but I know people that do, in that a hurting person should be helped because they're hurting, not because they can answer the question, well, what have you done for me lately?
Right.
Right? Okay.
Right. Well, no, I think that's right.
Yeah.
When we're dealing with God, we have a different issue. God, my obligation to my fellow creature is a different sort of obligation than God's obligation to me as his creation. And my sins, your sins are not an excuse for me to not act favorably toward you, but God is justified in taking my sins into account when he's deciding how he's going to deal with me. So that's a different... Yeah, all I'm saying is Jesus, in his acts of mercy, I'm not saying he decided who was worthy or not. He's just, he is being merciful to people in trouble. And that is a kind of a picture of what he ultimately came to do, in a more specific and complex way.